flows. This is a line from Finnegan's Wake. She shall ebb, E-B-B, music, way river, W-A-Y-R-I-V-E-R, she flows. She shall ebb, music, way river, she flows. I'm sure Joyce had a good reason to spell it that way. But 99% of humanity escape the reason and don't care what it means. She shall ebb music wherever she flows. The king of heart. Here comes everybody. He wears his people on his sleeve. Here comes everybody. He wears his people on his sleeve. McLuhan said TV forced everybody to be socially correct. So they all started to wear a lot of do-gooderness on their sleeves. But now, 10 years later, McLuhan's sick of it. So he says, here comes everybody. He wears his people on his sleeve. The put-on of the emperor as opposed to the leadership of the leader. The emperor's not going anywhere, so he just sits there and puts on everybody.
Yeah, that's an interesting juxtaposition where people want the position of being the emperor so they can be above everybody, not even see the masses, whereas in political correctness and the whole social aspect of the world now, everybody thinks they have to be a bleeding heart and be a social activist and help the poor, and they get lauded.
Mm.
And, you know, Ion tells us that's not, you know, where's that getting you type of thing.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. I dozed off. I did not remember what we're talking about.
A micro doze.
Yeah. I've been sitting here for 12 fucking hours or something, maybe 14 hours.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, at least you danced during the beginning.
I do.
Yeah, so what were you just saying, Carol? I did have something to say about it.
You know, it used to be that people wanted to be the emperor and laud over everybody and not even care about little man, but now little man is their excuse for being socially engaged and taking care of the homeless and the downtrodden, and that's how people elevate themselves.
Okay, so I think the correction would be that the emperor, especially the Oriental emperors, put on people. They just wore them like the pharaoh, mm-hmm. and they didn't try to help anybody.
Right.
Okay? It's the leader, the literate, kinetic, industrialized leader who has a point of view and a goal, and part of it was to improve the lot of poor people and educate them. That was a 19th century phenomenon. So you have it backwards.
To educate them, but just in a put-down sense, it's like, I'm above you. It's still the emperor motif, but it's totally different. They get involved with the poor people and
who want, does not yeah. the emperor.
No, not the emperor.
The leader does.
The leader gets involved with the poor people.
Yeah, and he goes around, and because he's doing good for people, he gets mean.
Yeah.
You know, he says, "Oh, I can afford to, you know, irritate or get rid of individuals that bother me." Because I'm doing a good thing. I'm leading the people.
Yes, yes, yeah. Justify the means.
Yeah. Mm. That's a literate leader. He's going somewhere. He's got a purpose. He's got a program. Mm. And we had that. That was all those leaders, W.T. Stead and these people, the 19th century, and then into the 20th century, and the suffragettes and the unions and Joe Hill. And then it became little man's world in 1950s. That was the peak period. You know, they had abundance, their kids could go to college, they were well paid, good vacations, and then the computer came in the late 60s and evaporated everybody. And then that made hard times for everybody again, no longer a comfortable middle class.
I take that too as the flip on, instead of wearing your heart on your sleeve, which is somebody who's genuinely vulnerable and I guess empathetic, he wears his people on his sleeve. It was almost like the put-on or the PR version of, you know, like donating to charities, being a philanthropist. These people that I'm donating to, those are the people sort of he's wearing on his sleeve, like almost like the put on of being selfless or.
And badges, like they're all lined up as badges of his honor.
Okay, so the leader, the leader who's used to running the show and can be wearing his concern of progress on the sleeve. Then you get into the 20th century where there's nowhere to go. Then the leader tries to be put on a bit of the put on of the emperor, and the best he can come up with is about how great a guy he is in helping social causes. That's an attempt to be a put on to be in the eternal present, which is what the emperor is good at.
It can also be Facebook followers.
Yeah. Political correctness is the last gasp of the literate. You know, he says, Harley Parker came up with, good taste is the last refuge of the witless. Well, political correctness is the last refuge of the visually biased, or POB. It's their attempt to put on group consciousness. And they're a little uptight about it, so they force everybody to go along with it, because they're embarrassed that they have to drop their individualist anarchy.
Isn't that sort of like the same line that the candidates right now running for president are towing with their candidacy?
Hello, this is Dr. Carolyn Dean. I'm sorry I will not be able to answer any. Hello, this is Dr. Carolyn Dean. I'm sorry I will not be able to answer any telephone.
Is that Carolyn's way of telling us that she's not talking anymore?
Something happened to the phones. The phones. Bob's had problems with his phone since the beginning, Bart.
Oh, really?
Another.
Hello, this is Dr. Carolyn Dean. I'm sorry I will not be able to answer any telephone.
I don't think he's really sorry.
No, Bob had problems with at the beginning of the show. Roxanne can fill in, but then Bill had to call him. Yes, he now is calling back.
Okay.
I'm sorry, nobody's home.
Okay. I just yelled up the camera.
I'm back.
Okay.
I saw that.
So, Bert, you got to go. One more card, the Joker. And it says...
Yeah, I'm okay.
Kink, what? What'd you say, Bert?
I'm okay, yes. I'm here.
All right. Kink in his arts over sense. It's from Finning is Awake. It's a kick in his arse over sense or over something. Kink, a kick in his arse, but it becomes a kink. K-I-N-K, in his arts, A-R-T-S. That means the Gutenberg arts don't work anymore. And it's over sense or over whether you should be chaotic like Finning Its Wake. What kind of sense should the artist make? And he has a kink in his arts because if he doesn't know the tactility is the extended situation of no sense, then he gets stuck in the rearview mirror sensory dogmatic.
Or art was making no sense to most people.
Yeah, kink in his arts over sense. Yes, a lot of people didn't understand the modernism. Yeah, that's a good way. A kick in his arse over the sense of what he's doing. Anyways, it's a good pun. Kink in his arts. So
over
there we
sense.
Are, Bert. We have done a McLuhan set tonight. Isn't that incredible? We did
it. Yes.
And we will...
Just a little background. Did he do this all alone, or did Harley Parker, and then you mentioned another gentleman, so it was Harley Parker, McLuhan, and the other gentleman that you mentioned.
The little guy, George Thompson. George Thompson.
Yeah.
And there might have been another two guys hanging around. I mean, I think they did it when he came back from Fordham in 68, because they get released in 69.
But McLuhan was always a punster. Every talk he ever gave, he'd throw out his one-liners, so he must have had a collection of them.
Yeah, he collected them.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them he probably collected, but they did have, George told me once, they had to come up with it, and he told the story of him contributing the small brains thing. And then George became Marshall's administrator, and then George gave Marshall the wine, that when Marshall had his stroke, and that did Marshall in. So George is the culprit for that. And George just died a couple of years ago at the age of 93. He outlived them all.
Mm.
But a lot of the McLuhan colleagues died, like Harley Parker died years ago. I'm the only colleague still standing. I beat out George. And George used to be outraged at me. He used to make up fucking ridiculous stories about me. Because I became Margaret's friend, and Margaret couldn't stand George. And George was intimidated by Margaret, so I was Margaret's friend, and Nelson was George's friend. And never the twain shall meet.
But then you interviewed and lauded George at the end, like you do with everybody. You always
include. Yes. Go to McLuhan on Maui. Yeah, for anybody who's listening, go to McLuhan on Maui. It's one of the earliest shows. We have a great interview with George Thompson, and he tells what no one has ever heard. He described what happened to Marshall when Marshall collapsed. He described Marshall's face. He gave the details of Marshall's collapse. We politely did not bring up that George caused it, but he did give a firsthand explanation of the murder that he carried out on Marshall.
You know, the standard thing to do was to, if someone sort of fainted or collapsed, you gave them a sip of alcohol to try to revive them. I'll have to do some Googling on that. I've never thought of it before. Does alcohol really extend a stroke, or does it act a bit like a blood thinner if the stroke is caused by a blood clot? I mean, we don't know. It could go either way.
Okay, let me play. Let's play a little bit of George. Let's play this particular mom. So, did Bert go?
No, I'm still here.
Okay, so...
I'm still here.
We'll wait for your message where you type in the InQuick. Thanks for everything, Bob. Talk to you next week.
Yes.
Right? You do that.
Yeah, and especially thanks to Carolyn. She made it all just so perfect and wonderful when she comes on every morning at 4 a.m. Maui time.
your fiddle is singing.
What?
Your fiddle has no singing. Music. Like a, her fiddle is singing.
is what? What is it? The fiddle? It is.
Hell hath no music like a woman playing second fiddle.
Right. So Carolyn does not have that problem. She could always be first fiddle if she was married to me. That's what she figured out. Do you know that? Remember that, Carolyn? Some psychic told me decades ago, you'll always be second.
Yes.
Remember that? How little did they know? It was one of the most incorrect predictions in psychic history ever made. But on the surface, I am second. I'm always second.
And you like that. You like hiding behind my skirts, although I don't wear skirts much.
I hide behind your jack-of-all-trades reality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was thinking about that. When we were at City Island and we had to nail the bed into the wall to make a wall bed to make it go up and down, and Bob Marshall was there, and he was a carpenter, and he fucking it got all fucked up, so he couldn't make the bed fit. It got stuck, and he worked on it for hours and hours, and then we gave up, and he and I went off somewhere. We came back. Meanwhile, little Carolyn had walked up, went up the ladder, went up the fucking thing, and fixed it. Remember that, Carol? You fixed the bed. And, like, you had to be strong to do it. And Bob Marshall couldn't get over it. He couldn't. How the hell did Carolyn do that?
Mm-hmm.
But if he just quietly left, Carolyn would fix it. She'd always fix it somehow.
Well, my philosophy is if somebody else has done it, then it's doable. And that's the premise.
Nobody has done it. Ed didn't do it.
No, but someone in the world has made those wall beds and get them to work. So there must be a way to do it. So that's a premise from which I start my operation.
Right. And you know what slack I've gotten. Carol's always been able to fix things. No matter what it is.
So Definitely privately first fiddle. She's first fiddle.
Yes. And I'm second fiddle, and I am codependent and have no fucking skills at anything. I'm a helpless little rich kid who can't do fuck all or anything.
And happy.
Happy to accept the role, though. I'm the first human to realize laziness is way better than anything else.
Well, whatever instrument you're playing, at least you got music going.
Yes. Yeah, what is that, the sentence? The fiddle is playing? What, how's that go?
Hell has no music.
No music like a woman playing second fiddle. So we have great music here.
It's heavenly music.
If the woman's playing first fiddle, heaven has a good music. That's what I'm good at.
If you're a black woman, Bob, then you can be the second fiddle role, according to that card.
I can be the second fiddle if I'm a black woman? What?
Yes, according. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in hell.
No, you're playing music that hell can't play.
Hell has no music. Oh yeah, hell can't. Like a woman playing second fiddle. I should put that on my DJ cards. Hell has no music like a black woman playing second fiddle. let's hear George. What do you think of that? Let's hear George talk for a minute. Let's see what it sounds like. Everybody, who got that, you, Roxy? You got knocked off?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Okay, so now Bert, have you gone, Bert? Bert's probably gone, right?
No, I'm going to hang out another 15 minutes. I'm going to be here for another 15 minutes.
Okay, well, let's play this. And it's George Thompson and Gerd Stern. You know, Gerd Stern is good. So we bring up... I'll mute everybody just to make it good quality.
All participants are now muted.
Bring up the Soundflower. That's in place. Okay, it should work. Okay, I'll just start this.
Say something.
Hello?
No, you're not muted.
Well, okay.
Yes,
that's Carol. Okay, this
Carol
is...
Carol from New York?
No, that's Carol. Carol lives with Michael Edmonds. I can hear in the background Mike's telling her to mute.
Can you still hear
me? Yeah. So we begin, in true Finnegan's Wake style, we begin in the middle. So this is our second Monday night seminar, recorded on March 7th, 2011. And our special guest tonight is George Thompson. George Thompson met Marsha McLuhan probably through Harley Parker, unless George will correct me on that, and was involved with the McLuhan Center since the mid-60s and worked on the Dewline card game that McLuhan produced in 1968. And he worked on the design of the book Counterblast that came out in 1969. There's other things that George did in that period. Then he became Marshall's assistant, replacing Morris McLuhan in the early 70s, and was with McLuhan until he passed on. So, welcome, George. An honor to have you here. And I would begin. I think since Michael Evans, who's here, has interviewed you before. What's something, Michael, you forgot to ask George? Let's just begin with that, if you can think of something.
Yeah, I actually have a question, George. Except I'm sure I got a paper here because I was thinking about this. But it relates to Harley Parker, which I think is an important question. In 1965, February 1 and 8, Harley presented... to the Monday night seminar at the Center for Culture and Technology. and he talked on a topic called From the Iconic to the Pictorial and Back. Okay, and I mean, we can maybe look at more of what he said later, but my question is, so he goes a lot into the whole business there of visual bias of the Renaissance, and he has a whole history of art that he brings to the Monday night seminars. My question really relates to is Harley already being biased in 1965 by having talked with McLuhan, or is he bringing this himself to the table, so to speak, for McLuhan to learn?
I was thinking the latter. Marshall did not have too much knowledge of art specifically, and so he relied on Harley and myself for what knowledge he had about art, and of course that was enhanced by René Seurat. René Seurat was, I don't know where his home base is, but he painted the great mural that we had in our studio for years. Yeah, three part.
Pied Pipers, all Pied Pipers.
Presentation.
Yeah, speak up, Michael. You have to speak a little louder. Your reception's
you
not perfect.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Yes, a little loud. That's good.
The René Seurat painting that George is referring to is the Pied Pipers using the eye and the ear famous mural that's in the coach house.
Yeah, and it's on our website, McLuhanConference.blogspot.com. You see it. And it was called Pied Pipers All, I think. Wasn't that right, George?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I'll say this. In 1971, I was talking to Harley Parker, and he said he taught Marshall everything that Marshall knew about art. Harley Parker would agree with George.
I would think so, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a vague philosophy, but it's quite true.
So in a way, what you're saying, George, is that, I mean, to me it shows that the great affinity that both McLuhan and Harley would have for each other. They would be like like-minded people.
That's right. Such a thing as perception in everything we do and see and feel and hear. And in all art, there's an understanding of what is perception. When you look at a painting or a drawing or whatever piece of art you want to call it, but that's my feeling anyhow.
Percept
and I tried to convey.
Concept.
Pardon?
Percept versus concept.
Yeah, that's right.
George, are you aware that McLuhan would study the, what he called the pagan art of the secret societies? And he said that the techniques that the Gnostics and the pagans developed in relation to the senses were invaluable for understanding art. They weren't valuable for salvation, that's what he'd be speaking as a Catholic, but they were valuable for understanding the role of perception and the stages of apprehension in art. Would you agree with that? Does that sound familiar to you?
It's not familiar to me, no, but I still stand with my point on perception.
Say that again, Lives.
I still believe that it's perception.
Right, but the controversy McLuhan had was that as a Catholic, he had to have an explanation of why he studied the secret societies. And I understand he actually had you go over to the Kelly Library and look up all the Freemasonic literature.
Well, he did that too, yes.
Why do you think he was doing that?
I have no idea. Curiosity, I suppose. He was very much interested in the Masonic order, but in a reverse or a negative viewpoint.
That's right. But he does say in his letters to Pound in the early 50s that you can look at that information to understand perception.
I guess so, yeah.
Okay, does someone...
So would you say then on that topic, when McLuhan is looking at the cubist or the symbolist painters, what would he be thinking?
I didn't get that.
When McLuhan starts talking about the cubist movement in art or the symbolist, what would he be thinking back to?
You're fading away.
You're gonna have to yell, Mike. Don't mind, just yell.
Okay. I was just basically saying when McLuhan then, because we know Parker would be talking about the cubist and about the symbolist, that would McLuhan be bringing that dimension in then of the past, the way far past?
Now do it better. You got to yell, Mike.
I'm going pretty low. Maybe I should get another.
Bob,
phone.
Maybe you can paraphrase the question.
I'm going to go to another phone, okay?
Okay.
So I'll just leave it for a sec.
Okay. Marshall wrote about art, George, you know, since the 40s. Usually, and he was aware of Picasso and the Dadaists and Duchamp, and some say that The Mechanical Bride was named after a work of art by Duchamp. You went to art school there in Toronto. Did you ever talk art with him, particular history of art of the early 20th century?
No, I never did. No, when I was in art school, Harley Parker was my color teacher. And I got into a terrible accident because of that, arguing with a friend in my car on the way home from a... And it was a terrible accident.
Well,
my friend finally died 2 years ago.
Your friend died?
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
And then,
or just last year.
Right, and you're saying this... But you're okay in the accident.
I was okay, yeah.
But you were arguing over color that Harley Parker had presented in his class?
Yeah.
Well, was Harley new? Was he avant-garde? Was he different from the teachers there?
I couldn't say because I'm also an unknown quantity. I don't know anything about anything except what I'm taught.
But didn't Harley teach you color theory? Can you hear me now, Bob?
Yeah, it's just a little better, but you're going to have to talk as loud as you can, because
right,
George won't hear it.
All right. Didn't Harley teach you color theory? George?
To whom are you speaking?
Michael.
No, Michael is asking you, George, did Harley teach you color theory?
George,
Harley?
You there?
Yeah, he's there.
I'm here. No. Harry taught me color theory and a lot of other things at art school. I accidentally bumped into him some years later when he was a chief designer of the ROM.
Royal Ontario Museum.
Yeah. I had wasted the first 10 years of my life drafting.
Wasted the first 10 years.
And finally, I quit one day, one afternoon. Friday, I went into the boss and said, I quit. I don't like this anymore. And I went down to the museum. I said, Harley, do you need any help? And he said, I sure do. My assistant has just left, and I'm in a terrible mess. I have all these problems. Perhaps you can help me out.
Well, you walked from your job to Harley same day.
Yeah.
Pretty good synchronicity. So what is
year
this?
Was that, George?
Yeah. Is this before he met Marshall?
About the same time.
Okay. And is Sputnik...
Because,
do you remember if Sputnik was up? Who was the president? Who was Diefenbaker prime minister at that time?
Who was before Diefenbaker?
I don't know. He was in there a long time. It wasn't Pearson. I'm just trying to relate it to something in the social life that you could connect the time. I don't know if you can remember dates. Is it the 50s, you think, George?
Pardon?
Do you think it's in the 50s you went to Harley?
Oh, yes, early 50s.
Okay, so you were born in 1917, right?
That's right.
Okay, so you're 21. That'd be 1938. Is that when you start working, or are you in school longer?
No, George was in World War II.
Oh, okay.
He came back and went on a veterans program to go to school, and he chose to go to art school.
So that'd be the late 40s.
Yeah.
So then you graduate maybe by 1950 after 3 years in school. So that means you would work 10 years till 1960.
No, it doesn't work out like that. In 1960, I was still in art school.
Wow, you went back to school late.
Pardon?
Where did you go to art school? In Toronto?
Yeah, it's the Ontario College of Art.
Yesterday was 19. Good night. I'm 94. Numbers screw me up.
Okay. Well, we know you met...
It was the famous OCA, Ontario College of Art.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I think that you would have been out of there by 1960, because you didn't hang around doing nothing for 5 years before you went to school. Or did you? Did you go to school right after World War II?
No.
Oh, okay. So it's a few years.
I was
years.
A surveyor.
Okay.
Ontario landscape surveyor.
How long was that?
For a couple of years. It comes to my mind now when we talk about it. I started art school in 1946, I guess.
That's when you went to art school?
Yeah.
Okay, so you do that for 3 years approximately, right?
4 years.
So there's 1950, and then you get a job right away drafting?
Pretty well, yeah.
Okay, so about 1960 is when you walk into the museum and see Harley.
No, you got all screwed up. After art school.
Yeah, that's
1951, you're right.
Okay, so you worked there about 10 years, so that's 1961, drafting, right?
That's right.
So 61, 62, you meet Harley, and I understand, according to Marchand's biography, it seems to be the late 50s, early 60s that Harley walks in. No, McLuhan walks into Harley's show in Windsor or someplace.
London, Ontario.
Yeah.
London, Ontario.
Yeah.
And then that's when he found McLuhan's mind in response to the Harley's paintings. He was interested
that's
in
right.
that. Yeah. So then
that's
that,
right.
And then around.
Yeah, you got that all straight.
Beg your pardon?
That's okay.
Yeah. So now,
I'll buy that. Yeah.
So when you start working with Harley, does he tell you about McLuhan pretty quickly, or is it after a couple of years there?
No, it was a little bit later. And he told me once how he met Marshall. Harley was having an art show in London, a Fanshawe College.
Yeah.
And he wasn't selling very much. And he was a bit disappointed. And there's this tall, thin man kept looking at his paintings and studying them. And then going back a few feet and look at them again. And puzzled. And Harley finally gave up. He says, hello, I don't know who you are, sir, but I'm Hardy Parker, the painter. And he said, oh, hi, I'm Marshall McLuhan. I teach English. And that was the first time they'd ever met.
So why? Okay, go ahead.
Oh, and after that, they became pretty good friends. And Hardy was interested in what Marsha was doing, or studying, or lecturing in the coach house.
Well, not the coach house. That hadn't happened yet. This would be that home. I mean, the St. Joseph Street.
No.
Well, would it be? Did it have the name Center for Culture and Technology yet?
At that time that I was there, yes.
Okay, well, St. Joseph's had that from 63 to 68. But see, you're already involved in McLuhan before the coach house becomes available after Fordham. So it has to be the previous place.
Well, I remember the previous place, and that was just an office.
Yeah, that was with Mark Stewart.
Yeah.
Okay, so he would have meetings in there?
Occasionally.
So what happened the first time you went with Harley to one of these meetings that you recall?
Nothing. Except Marshall would say, we need some wine. Wine? Yes, we need some wine. George, we're all on the first name basis.
Right.
Would you mind going and getting some wine? What kind do you want? What was the wine, the cheapest wine you can buy? So I will come back with a gallon of this crap. And we would serve that to all the students and anybody who wanted to come in.
Good. That's the beginning of the Monday night seminars.
That's right.
The wine distill, wine dispensary.
Especially the time that I tripped as I came in the door and spilled the bottle and it smashed on the door. And I had to go and get some more.
So why did you...
Again, the damn stuff gave me a headache, so I never drank it.
Why were you chosen
to
set
that headache, don't you, George?
Pardon?
You still have that headache, don't you?
I do not have the headache anymore. Well, I was pretty close to it the other night.
So why, since you hardly knew Marshall, why did he ask you to go get the wine?
I have no idea. I was with Harry.
Okay, so in the seminar,
I have a slightly different question I wanted to ask about your work with Harley at the ROM, because McLuhan became involved with it, the famous exhibit with the mask, which was the groundbreaking for museum exhibitions. You were involved with that, right?
That's right.
Do you have any stories about that? Because I heard that kind of ruined Harley's reputation at the museum, and maybe McLuhan's too.
I didn't, and that's the first I ever heard of any stuff like that. No, that did not hurt Harley. That was his crowning achievement. And we had the Premier of Ontario and other dignitaries all the way down the line to the mayor.
Was McLuhan?
And they all came. They all came to the opening. And Peter Swan, a horrible little man who was the director of the museum at the time, he attended and took all the glory and all the applause for our great opening of our new gallery. And it went off quite well, actually.
That's good. But
didn't hey, Michael, actually... Michael, what is this? What?
Okay, I want to mention something here. Let me unmute people. Are you still here?
Unmuted.
Are you still here, Bert? Bert, leave. See if he left me a message. Yep. I'm cutting out now. Thanks for everything. Warm regards to Carol. Okay. Someone like Bert might notice this. Anybody who's listened to a lot of ION through the years will hear the occasional mockery of George by ION as the guy who went and got the wine. And Marcel has, ION has mentioned, he's mentioned many variations on the joke of getting wine that George was the symbol of. Something, you know, ION would talk about the seminars and he'd say, you know, the place of the cheap wine. So, ION knew about that, or he heard this. Now let me see what else say about that. I don't know how much more.
So you're saying that this was George's first act with McLuhan was to bring the wine, and his last act with McLuhan was to bring him wine.
Good point. Yes, and he that's his role all through the years. He was the gopher to get the wine. He was the second class, second fiddle guy. Because Harley was the main guy, and he was just an assistant to Harley. So McLuhan always, I mean, George is a bit clueless sounding. He sort of was clueless, but he was cagey and shrewd. It's hard to figure out George. I'd say he, in general, he was on the incompetent side, and therefore, you know, always had the gopher positions. And even in this dialogue, I don't want to play too much more of it, because we have to drag stuff out of George, but then we want him to describe, let's get to the part where he describes Marshall dropping. We will do that. Anybody have anything else to say?
No, it's good to hear the game.
Right. I don't know if I want to play it all, but I'll move it forward and we'll see if we can find the part where he's talking about Marshall. Anybody can go to... what is it, McLuhan on Maui, and listen to this. It's the second seminar. Let's see if we can find the
is this the masks? What is the mask referring?
Going to get run over, right? So I get in a panic, and I said, I wonder. So I sneaked up the stairs very silently, and there she was, underneath Marshall's table, wherever he was sitting. And he had his hand on her head, and she was looking so thoughtful, the little dog.
And, in the warehouse?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
Did you know that at Fordham... the controversy over paying McLuhan and Ford
Parker and Marshall McLuhan looked alike.
Yeah.
They had the same personality on a speaker's platform. It was just terrible when Harley lost his voice through cancer.
Yeah.
And he said he would never use a mechanical thing to make himself speak. So he taught himself to speak.
Well,
and he never did use a mechanical device of any kind.
Well, do you remember Sheila Watson coming around?
Watson?
Yeah, Sheila Watson and Wilfred Watson.
What about them?
You remember them being at the coach house?
Oh, yes.
I'm not surprised about Winnipeg.
He thought, well, let's forget drugs, let's go. So how they talk like they talk because of the reason McLuhan said is...
Pardon?
Did you hear of the conflict between Wilfred Watson and Marshall? Do you remember the beginning of the newsletter idea itself?
Just a few weeks, a week or so before that, the Queen of England, the real Queen, had come over to do her due duties by the installation of this brand new machine.
Hey, George?
Yeah?
Do you know what Eleanor Austin's reaction was? Because she was in the building. Was his reaction?
There wasn't any. Oh.
So you think maybe his asking you that was just a probe?
No. He was quite genuine.
He was genuine.
This is quoting Marshall, and I quote from one of his letters. My task as a teacher will be to shake others from their complacency. How is it possible to conflate the products of English life, etc., literature, etc., without criticizing our own sterility? And that was a key to Marshall's teachings and his philosophy. He could not stand stupidity.
No.
But that's my opinion.
Right. That was told to me by Ed Wakin, who did a couple of good interviews that were...
Pardon?
Did you hear of the conflict between Wilfred Watson...
I'm not surprised about Lynn.
All in tonight. He's aware of this evening. No cartoons. Yeah, you... And Crick and Watson discovered the gene... Cluen scholar, he actually organized the bibliography of the Gutenberg Galaxy. He's no longer...
Well, what that's all about, I say, first you...
...the nervous system, and the satellite extended the planet...
...and it wasn't safe.
Pardon?
Did you hear of the conflict between Wilfred Watson and Marshall at the Cochos in the late 60s after Fordham?
I did not hear.
Okay.
Not directly. I just heard the...
And Marshall's in that novel as a character. Do you remember the beginning of the newsletter idea itself? But wouldn't be able to continue to ask him questions, so they have to go to you.
That's right.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Marshall was one of the great orators of all time.
Yeah, I think that when you...
He had a great stage presentation.
Yeah, several actors I've met through the years, they'd never... Marshall, would you agree with that?
No. Chesterton, for one. Just a few weeks, a week or so before.
That looks like Harmon left to...
If someone worth remembering, so that's why it's fun. Okay, I can't find it. Forget that. You guys can go listen to it and find it. Listen to the whole thing. And hear about George. Oh, there's only one person. So is that you, Roxana? One person left.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. So
yeah.
I think we have finished the McLuhan section.
And now we're going to play another part of Rewrite. So,
okay.
Nobody else here to talk. So, we're happy to hear Rewrite?
Yes, now I'm awake.
All right, so Rewrite, that would be number 34. So I think we've got an hour and a half left. And if Ian comes back next week, then we probably wouldn't play any more Rewrite. Right. Okay, so it's sticking to downloading. It goes to hour and a half, 5:26. So we go to here, 3:59:36. Yeah, 3:59:36. I'll just check what's happening in the chat line. Leon and Jean talking. Okay. Roxy, thanks for participating on the Zappa thing and the McLuhan Dew line. And I'll be here at the end of this if anybody wants to talk a little bit.